Pleased with himself for having elicited this long, passionate speech from Otsu, Jotaro jumped in the air, laughing and clapping his hands. "Now who's parroting Master Arakida? You thought I hadn't heard that before, didn't you?" "Oh, you're impossible," exclaimed Otsu, laughing herself. She would have cuffed him one, but her bundle was in the way. Still smiling, she glared at the boy, who finally took notice of her unusual parcel. "Whose are those?" he asked, stretching out his hand. "Don't touch them. We don't know whose they are." "Oh, I'm not going to break anything. I just want to look." "I bet they're heavy. That long sword's really big, isn't it?" Jotaro's mouth was watering.
"Sensei!"
With a patter of straw sandals, one of the shrine maidens ran up.
"Master Arakida is calling for you. I think there's something he wants you to do."
Scarcely pausing, she turned and ran back. Jotaro looked around in all four directions, a startled expression on his face. The wintry sun was shining through the trees, and the twigs swayed like wavelets. His eyes looked as though they had spotted a phantom among the patches of sunlight.
"What's the matter?" asked Otsu. "What are you looking at?"
"Oh, nothing," replied the boy dejectedly, biting his forefinger. "When that girl called teacher, I thought for a second she meant my teacher." Otsu, too, suddenly felt sad and a little annoyed. Though Jotaro's remark had been made in all innocence, why did he have to mention Musashi? Despite Takuan's advice, she could not conceive of trying to expel from her heart the longing she cherished for Musashi. Takuan was so unfeeling. In a way, she pitied him and his apparent ignorance of the meaning of love. Love was like a toothache. When Otsu was busy, it did not bother her, but when the remembrance struck her, she was seized by the urge to go out on the highways again, to search for him, to find him, to place her head on his chest and shed tears of happiness. Silently, she started walking. Where was he? Of all the sorrows that beset living beings, surely the most gnawing, the most wretched, the most agonizing was not to be able to lay eyes on the person one pined for. Tears streaming down her cheeks, she walked on. The heavy swords with their worn fittings meant nothing to her. How could she have dreamed she was carrying Musashi's own belongings? Jotaro, sensing he had done something wrong, followed sadly a short distance behind. Then, as Otsu turned into the gate at the Arakida house, he ran up to her and asked, "Are you angry? About what I said?"
"Oh, no. It's nothing. I'm sorry, Otsu. I really am. It's not your fault. I just feel kind of sad. But don't worry about it. I'm going to find out what Master Arakida wants. You go back to your work."
Arakida Ujitomi called his home the House of Study. He had converted part of it into a school, attended not only by the shrine maidens, but also by 40 or 50 other children from the three counties belonging to Ise Shrine. He was trying to impart to the young a type of learning not currently very popular, the study of ancient Japanese history, which in the more sophisticated towns and cities was considered irrelevant. The early history of the country was intimately connected with Ise Shrine and its lands, but this was an age when people tended to confuse the fate of the nation with that of the warrior class, and what had happened in the distant past counted for little. Ujitomi was fighting a lonely battle to plant the seeds of an earlier, more traditional culture among the young people from the shrine area. While others might claim provincial regions had nothing to do with the national destiny, Ujitomi took a different view. If he could teach the local children about the past, perhaps, he thought, its spirit would one day thrive like a great tree in the sacred forest. With perseverance and devotion, he talked to the children each day about the Chinese classics and the Record of Ancient Matters, the earliest history of Japan, hoping that his charges would eventually come to value these books. He had been doing this for more than 10 years. To his way of thinking, Hideyoshi might seize control of the country and proclaim himself regent. Tokugawa Ieyasu might become the omnipotent, barbarian-subduing shogun, but young children should not, like their elders, mistake the lucky star of some military hero for the beautiful sun. If he labored patiently, the young would come to understand that it was the great sun goddess, not an uncouth warrior dictator, who symbolized the nation's aspirations. Arakida emerged from his spacious classroom, his face a little sweaty. As the children flew out like a swarm of bees and darted quickly off to their homes, a shrine maiden told him Otsu was waiting. Somewhat flustered, he said,
"That's right. I sent for her, didn't I? I completely forgot. Where is she?"
Otsu was just outside the house, where she had been standing for some time listening to Arakida's lecture.
"Here I am," she called. "Did you want me?" "I'm sorry to have kept you waiting. Come inside."
He led her to his private study, but before sitting down, pointed to the objects she was carrying and asked what they were. She explained how she came to have them. He squinted and stared suspiciously at the swords.
"Ordinary worshippers wouldn't come here with things like that," he said. "And they weren't there last evening. Somebody must have come inside the walls in the middle of the night."
Then, with a distasteful expression on his face, he grumbled,
"This may be some samurai's idea of a joke, but I don't like it."
"Oh? Can you think of anyone who would want to suggest that a man had been in the House of Virgins?"
"Yes, I can. As a matter of fact, that's what I wanted to talk to you about."
"Does it concern me in some way?"
"Well, I don't want you to feel bad about it, but it's like this. There's a samurai who has taken me to task for putting you in the same dormitory with the shrine maidens. He says he's warning me for my own sake."
"Have I done something that reflects on you?"
"There's no reason to be upset. It's just that, well, you know how people talk. Now, don't be angry. But after all, you're not exactly a maiden. You've been around men, and people say it tarnishes the shrine to have a woman who's not a virgin living together with the girls in the House of Virgins."
Although Arakida's tone was casual, angry tears flooded Otsu's eyes. It was true that she had traveled around a lot, that she was used to meeting people, that she had wandered through life with this old love clinging to her heart. Maybe it was only natural for people to take her for a woman of the world. It was nevertheless a shattering experience to be accused of not being chaste, when in fact she was. Arakida did not seem to attach much importance to the matter. It simply disturbed him that people were saying things, and since it was the end of the year, and all that, as he put it, he wondered if she would be so good as to discontinue the flute lessons and move out of the House of Virgins. Otsu consented quickly, not as an admission of guilt, but because she had not planned to stay on and did not want to cause trouble, especially to Master Arakida. Notwithstanding her resentment at the falseness of the gossip, she promptly thanked him for his kindnesses during her stay and said that she would leave within the day.
"Oh, it's not all that urgent," he assured her, reaching out to his small bookcase and taking out some money, which he wrapped in paper.
Jotaro, who had followed Otsu, chose this moment to put his head in from the veranda and whisper,
"If you're going to leave, I'll go with you. I'm tired of sweeping their old garden anyway."
"Here's a little gift," said Arakida. "It's not much, but take it and use it for travel money."
He held out the packet containing a few gold coins. Otsu refused to touch it.
With a shocked look on her face, she told him she deserved no pay for merely giving flute lessons to the girls. Rather, it was she who should be paying for her food and lodging.
"No," he replied, "I couldn't possibly take money from you, but there is something I'd like you to do for me in case you happen to be going to Kyoto. You can think of this money as payment for a favor."
"I'll be glad to do anything you ask, but your kindness is payment enough."
Arakida turned to Jotaro and said,
"Why don't I give him the money? He can buy things for you along the way."
"Thank you," said Jotaro, promptly extending his hand and accepting the packet. As an afterthought, he looked at Otsu and said, "It's all right, isn't it?"
Confronted with a fait accompli, she gave in and thanked Arakida.
"The favor I want to ask," he said, "is that you deliver a package from me to Lord Karasumaru Mitsuhiro, who lives at Horikawa in Kyoto."
While speaking, he took two scrolls down from the set of staggered shelves on the wall.
"Lord Karasumaru asked me 2 years ago to paint these. They're finally done. He plans to write in the commentary to go with the pictures and present the scrolls to the emperor. That's why I don't want to entrust them to an ordinary messenger or courier. Will you take them to him and make sure they don't get wet or soiled on the way?" This was a commission of unexpected importance, and Otsu hesitated at first. But it would hardly do to refuse, and after a moment she agreed.
Arakida then took out a box and some oiled paper, but before wrapping and sealing the scrolls, said,
"Perhaps I should show them to you first."
He sat down and began unrolling the paintings on the floor before them. He was obviously proud of his work and wanted to take a last look himself before parting with it. Otsu gasped at the beauty of the scrolls, and Jotaro's eyes widened as he bent over to examine them more closely. Since the commentary had not yet been written in, neither of them knew what story was depicted. But as Arakida unrolled scene after scene, they saw before them a picture of life at the ancient imperial court, fastidiously executed in magnificent colors with touches of powdered gold. The paintings were in the Tosa style, which was derived from classic Japanese art. Though Jotaro had never been taught anything about art, he was dazzled by what he saw.
"Look at the fire there," he exclaimed. "It looks like it's really burning, doesn't it?"
"Don't touch the painting," admonished Otsu. "Just look." While they gazed in admiration, a servant entered and said something in a very low voice to Arakida, who nodded and replied,
"I see. I suppose it's all right. Just in case, though, you'd better have the man make out a receipt."
With that, he gave the servant the pack and the two swords Otsu had brought to him. Upon learning that their flute teacher was leaving, the girls in the House of Virgins were disconsolate. In the 2 months she had been with them, they had come to regard her as an elder sister, and their faces, as they gathered about her, were full of gloom.
"Is it true? Are you really going away? Won't you ever come back?"
From beyond the dormitory, Jotaro shouted, "I'm ready! What's taking you so long?" He had doffed his white robe and was once again dressed in his usual short kimono, his wooden sword at his side. The cloth-wrapped box containing the scrolls was suspended diagonally across his back. From the window, Otsu called back,
"My, that was fast."
"I'm always fast," retorted Jotaro. "Aren't you ready yet? Why does it take women so long to dress and pack?" He was sunning himself in the yard, yawning lazily. But being impatient by nature, he quickly grew bored.
"Aren't you finished yet?" he called again.
"I'll be there in a minute," Otsu replied.
She'd already finished packing, but the girls wouldn't let her go. Attempting to break away, Otsu said soothingly,
"Don't be sad. I'll come to visit one of these days. Till then, take good care of yourselves."
She had the uncomfortable feeling that this was not true, for in view of what had happened, it seemed unlikely that she would ever return. Perhaps the girls suspected this. Several were crying. Finally, someone suggested that they all see Otsu as far as the holy bridge across the Isuzu River. They thereupon crowded around her and escorted her out of the house. They didn't see Jotaro immediately, so they cupped their hands around their mouths and called his name, but got no reply. Otsu, too used to his ways to be disturbed, said he probably got tired of waiting and went on ahead.
"What a disagreeable little boy!" exclaimed one of the girls.
Another suddenly looked up at Otsu and asked, "Is he your son?"
"My son? How on earth could you think that? I won't even be 21 till next year. Do I look old enough to have a child that big?"
"No, but somebody said he was yours." Recalling her conversation with Arakida, Otsu blushed, then comforted herself with the thought that it made no real difference what people said, as long as Musashi had faith in her. Just then, Jotaro came running up to them.
"Hey, what's going on?" he said with a pout. "First you keep me waiting for ages, now you start off without me."
"But you weren't where you're supposed to be," Otsu pointed out.
"You could have looked for me, couldn't you? I saw a man over there on the Toba High Road who looked a little like my teacher. I ran over to see whether it was really him."
"Someone who looked like Musashi?"
"Yes, but it wasn't him. I went as far as that row of trees and got a good look at the man from behind, but it couldn't have been Musashi. Whoever it was had a limp."
It was always like this when Otsu and Jotaro were traveling. Not a day passed without their experiencing a glimmer of hope, followed by disappointment. Everywhere they went, they saw someone who reminded them of Musashi. The man passing by the window, the samurai in the boat that had just left, the ronin on horseback, the dimly seen passenger in a palanquin. Hopes soaring, they would rush to make sure, only to find themselves looking dejectedly at each other. It had happened dozens of times. For this reason, Otsu was not as upset now as she might have been, though Jotaro was crestfallen. Laughing the incident off, she said,
"Too bad you were wrong, but don't get mad at me for going on ahead. I thought I'd find you at the bridge. You know, everybody says that if you start out on a journey in a bad mood, you'll stay angry all the way. Come now, let's make up."
Though seemingly satisfied, Jotaro turned and cast a rude look at the girls trailing along behind.
"What are they all doing here? Are they coming with us?"
"Of course not. They're just sorry to see me leave, so they're sweet enough to escort us to the bridge."
"Why, that's so very kind of them," said Jotaro, mimicking Otsu's speech and throwing everyone into fits of laughter. Now that he had joined the group, the anguish of parting subsided, and the girls recovered their good spirits.
"Otsu," called one of them, "you're turning the wrong way. That's not the path to the bridge."
"I know," said Otsu quietly.
She had turned toward the Tamagushi Gate to pay her respects to the inner shrine. Clapping her hands together once, she bowed her head toward the sanctum and remained in an attitude of silent prayer for a few moments.
"Oh, I see," murmured Jotaro. "She doesn't think she should leave without saying goodbye to the goddess."
He was content to watch from a distance, but the girls started poking him in the back and asking him why he did not follow Otsu's example.
"Me?" asked the boy incredulously. "I don't want to bow before any old shrine."
"You shouldn't say that. You'll be punished for that someday."
"I'd feel silly bowing like that."
"What's silly about showing your respect to the sun goddess? She's not like one of those minor deities they worship in the cities."
"I know that."
"Well, then, why don't you pay your respect?"
"Because I don't want to."
"Contrary, aren't you?"
"Shut up, you crazy females, all of you."
"Oh, my," chorused the girls, dismayed at his rudeness. "What a monster," exclaimed one.
By this time, Otsu had finished her obeisance and was coming back toward them.
"What happened?"
she asked. "You look upset." One of the girls blurted, He called us crazy females just because we tried to get him to bow before the goddess.
Now, Jotaro, you know that's not nice, Otsu admonished. You really ought to say a prayer.
What for?
Didn't you say yourself that when you thought Musashi was about to be killed by the priests from the Hozoin, you raised your hands and prayed as loudly as you could? Why can't you pray here, too?
But, well, they're all looking.
All right. We'll turn around so we can't see you.
They all turned their backs to the boy, but Otsu stole a look behind her. He was running dutifully toward the Tamagushi gate. When he reached it, he faced the shrine and in very boyish fashion made a deep, lightning-quick bow. The Pinwheel. Musashi sat on the narrow veranda of a little seafood shop facing the sea. The shop's specialty was sea snails, served boiling in their shells. Two women divers, baskets of freshly caught turban shells on their arms, and a boatman stood near the veranda. While the boatman urged him to take a ride around the offshore islands, the two women were trying to convince him he needed some sea snails to take with him wherever he was headed. Musashi was busily engaged in removing the pus-soiled bandage from his foot. Having suffered intensely from his injury, he could hardly believe that both the fever and the swelling were finally gone. The foot was again normal size, and though the skin was white and shriveled, it was only slightly painful. Waving the boatman and divers away, he lowered his tender foot onto the sand and walked to the shore to wash it. Returning to the veranda, he waited for the shop girl he'd sent to buy new leather socks and sandals. When she came back, he put them on and took a few cautious steps. He still had a slight limp, but nothing like before. The old man cooking snails looked up.
"The ferryman's calling you. Weren't you planning to cross over to O Minato?"
"Yes, I think there's a regular boat from there to Tsu."
"There is, and there are also boats for Yokkaichi and Kuwana."
"How many days to the end of the year?"
The old man laughed.
"I envy you," he said. "It's plain you don't have any year-end debts to pay. Today's the 24th.
"Is that all? I thought it was later."
"How nice to be young."
As he trotted to the ferry landing, Musashi felt an urge to keep running, farther and farther, faster and faster. The change from invalid to healthy man had lifted his spirits, but what made him far happier was the spiritual experience he'd had that morning. The ferry was already full, but he managed to make room for himself. Directly across the bay, at O Minato, he changed to a bigger boat bound for Owari. The sails filled, and the boat glided over the glass-like surface of the Bay of Ise. Musashi stood huddled with the other passengers and gazed quietly across the water to his left, at the old market, Yamada, and the Matsuzaka High Road. If he went to Matsuzaka, he might have a chance to meet the prodigious swordsman Mikogami Tenzen, but no, it was too soon for that. He disembarked at Tsu as planned. No sooner was he off the boat when he noticed a man walking ahead of him with a short bar at his waist. Wrapped around the bar was a chain, and at the end of the chain was a ball. The man also wore a short field sword in a leather sheath. He looked to be 42 or 43. His face, as dark as Musashi's, was pockmarked, and his reddish hair was pulled back in a knot. He might have been taken for a freebooter, would it not for the young boy following him. Soot blackened both cheeks, and he carried a sledgehammer. He was obviously a blacksmith's apprentice.
"Wait for me, master!"
"Get a move on!"
"I left the hammer on the boat."
"Leaving behind the tools you make your living with, huh?"
"I went back and got it."
"And I suppose that makes you proud of yourself? The next time you forget anything, I'll crack your skull open for you."
"Master," the boy pleaded.
"Quiet!
Can't we spend the night at Tsu?"
"There's still plenty of daylight. We can make it home by nightfall."
I'd like to stop somewhere anyway. As long as we're on a trip, we might as well enjoy it.
Don't talk nonsense.
The street into the town was lined with souvenir shops and infested with in-touts, just as in other port towns. The apprentice again lost sight of his master and searched the crowd worriedly until the man emerged from a toy shop with a small, colorful pinwheel.
Iwa!
He called to the boy.
Yes, sir?
Carry this, and be careful it doesn't get broken. Stick it in your collar.
Souvenir for the baby?
Ugh, grunted the man.
After being away on a job for a few days, he was looking forward to seeing the child's grin of delight when he handed it over. It almost seemed that the pair were leading Musashi. Every time he planned to turn, they turned ahead of him. It occurred to Musashi that this blacksmith was probably Shishido Baiken, but he could not be sure, so he improvised a simple strategy to make certain. Feigning not to notice them, he went ahead for a time, then dropped back again, eavesdropping all the while. They went through the castle town and then toward the mountain road to Suzuka, presumably the route Baiken would take to his house. Putting this together with snatches of overheard conversation, Musashi concluded that this was, indeed, Baiken. He had intended to go straight to Kyoto, but this chance meeting proved too tempting. He approached and said in a friendly manner,
"Going back to Umehata?"
The man's reply was curt.
"Yes, I'm going to Umehata."
"Why?"
"I was wondering if you might be Shishido Baiken."
"I am. And who are you?"
"My name is Miyamoto Musashi. I'm a student warrior. Not long ago, I went to your house in Uji and met your wife. It looks to me as though fate brought us together here."
"Is that so?"
Baiken said. With a look of sudden comprehension on his face, he asked,
"Are you the man who was staying at the inn in Yamada, the one who wanted to have a bout with me?
How did you hear about that?"
"You sent someone to the Arakida house to find me, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"I was doing some work for Arakida, but I didn't stay at the house. I borrowed a workplace in the village. It was a job nobody could do but me."
"I see. I hear you're an expert with the chain ball sickle."
"Aha! But you said you met my wife?"
"Yes. She demonstrated one of the yaegaki stances for me."
"Well, that should be enough for you. There's no reason to be following along after me. Oh, of course, I could show you a great deal more than she did, but the minute you saw it, you'd be on your way to a different world."
Musashi's impression of the wife had been that she was pretty overbearing, but here was real arrogance. He was fairly sure from what he had seen already that he could take the measure of this man, but he cautioned himself not to be hasty. Takuan had taught him life's first lesson, namely that there are a lot of people in the world who may very well be one's betters. The lesson had been reinforced by his experiences at the Hozoin and at Koyagyu Castle. Before letting his pride and confidence betray him into underestimating an adversary, he wanted to size him up from every possible angle. While laying his groundwork, he would remain sociable, even if at times this might strike his opponent as being cowardly or subservient. In reply to Baiken's contemptuous remark, he said, with an air of respect befitting his youth,
"I see. I did indeed learn a good deal from your wife, but since I've had the good fortune to meet you, I'd be grateful if you'd tell me more about the weapon you use."
"If all you want to do is talk, fine. Are you planning to stay overnight at the inn by the barrier?"
"That's what I had in mind, unless you'd be kind enough to put me up for another night."
"You're welcome to stay, if you're willing to sleep in the smithy with Iwa. But I don't run an inn, and we don't have extra bedding."
At sunset, they reached the foot of Mount Suzuka. The little village, under red clouds, looked as placid as a lake. Iwa ran on ahead to announce their arrival, and when they got to the house, Baiken's wife was waiting under the eaves, holding the baby and the pinwheel.
"Look, look, look!" she cooed.
Daddy's been away. Daddy's come back. See, there he is.
In a twinkling, Daddy ceased to be the epitome of arrogance and broke into a fatherly smile.
Here, boy. Here's Daddy, he babbled, holding up his hand and making his fingers dance.
Husband and wife disappeared inside and sat down, talking only about the baby and household matters, paying no attention to Musashi. Finally, when dinner was ready, Baiken remembered his guest.
Oh, yes. Give that fellow something to eat, he told his wife.
Musashi was sitting in the dirt-floored smithy, warming himself by the forge. He hadn't even removed his sandals.
He was just here the other day. He spent the night,
the woman replied sullenly. She put some sake to warm in the hearth in front of her husband.
Young man, Baiken called. Do you drink sake?
I don't dislike it.
Have a cup.
Thanks.
Moving to the threshold of the hearth room, Musashi accepted a cup of the local brew and put it to his lips. It tasted sour. After downing it, he offered the cup to Baiken, saying,
Let me pour you a cup.
Never mind, I have one.
He looked at Musashi for an instant, then asked,
How old are you?
22.
Where do you come from?
Mimasaka.
Baiken's eyes, which had wandered off in another direction, swung back to Musashi, re-examining him from head to toe.
Let's see. You mentioned it a while ago. Your name? What's your name?
Miyamoto Musashi.
How do you write Musashi?
It's written the same way as Takezo.
The wife came in and put soup, pickles, chopsticks, and a bowl of rice on the straw mat before Musashi.
Eat,
she said unceremoniously.
Thanks, replied Musashi.
Baiken waited a couple of breaths, then said, as though to himself,
It's hot now. The sake.
Pouring Musashi another cup, he asked in an offhand manner,
Does that mean you were called Takezo when you were younger?
Yes.
Were you still called that when you were 17 or so?
Yes.
When you were about that age, you weren't by any chance at the Battle of Sekigahara with another boy about your age, were you?
It was Musashi's turn to be surprised.
How did you know? He said slowly.
Oh, I know a lot of things. I was at Sekigahara, too.
Hearing this, Musashi felt better disposed toward the man. Baiken, too, seemed suddenly more friendly.
I thought I'd seen you somewhere, said the blacksmith. I guess we must have met on the battlefield.
Were you in the Ukita camp, too?
I was living in Yasugawa then, and I went to the war with a group of samurai from there. We were in the front lines, we were.
Is that so?
I guess we probably saw each other then. Whatever happened to your friend?
I haven't seen him since.
Since the battle?
Not exactly. We stayed for a time at a house in Ibuki, waiting for my wounds to heal. We, parted there. That was the last I saw of him.
Baiken let his wife know they were out of sake. She was already in bed with the baby.
There isn't any more, she answered.
I want some more. Now!
Why do you have to drink so much tonight, of all nights?
We're having an interesting little talk here. Need some more sake.
But there isn't any.
Iwa!
He called through the flimsy board wall in a corner of the smithy.
What is it, sir?
Said the boy. He pushed open the door and showed his face, stooping because the lintel was so low.
Go over to Onosaku's house and borrow a bottle of sake.
Musashi had enough to drink.
If you don't mind, I'll go ahead and eat, he said, picking up his chopsticks.
No, no, wait, said Baiken, quickly grabbing Musashi's wrist. It's not time to eat. Now that I've sent for some sake, I have a little more.
If you were getting it for me, you shouldn't have.
I don't think I can drink another drop. Ah, come now,
Baiken insisted.
You said you wanted to hear more about the chain ball sickle. I'll tell you everything I know, but let's have a few drinks while we're talking.
When Iwa returned with the sake, Baiken poured some into a heating jar,
put it on the fire, and talked at great length about the chain ball sickle and ways to use it to advantage in actual combat. The best thing about it, he told Musashi, was that unlike a sword, it gave the enemy no time to defend himself. Also, before attacking the enemy directly, it was possible to snatch his weapon away from him with the chain. A skillful throw of the chain, a sharp yank, and the enemy had no more sword. Still seated, Baiken demonstrated a stance.
You see? You hold the sickle in your left hand and the ball in your right. If the enemy comes at you, you take him on with the blade, then hurl the ball at his face. That's one way.
Changing positions, he went on.
Now, in this case, when there's some space between you and the enemy, you take his weapon away with the chain. It doesn't make any difference what kind of weapon it is, sword, lance, wooden staff, or whatever.
Baiken went on, telling Musashi about ways of throwing the ball, about the 10 or more oral traditions concerning the weapon, about how the chain was like a snake, about how it was possible, by cleverly alternating the movements of the chain and the sickle, to create optical illusions and cause the enemy's defense to work to his own detriment, about all the secret ways of using the weapon. Musashi was fascinated. When he heard talk like this, he listened with his whole body, eager to absorb every detail. The chain, the sickle, two hands. As he listened, the seeds of other thoughts formed in his mind. The sword can be used with one hand, but a man has two hands. The second bottle of sake was empty. While Baiken had drunk a good deal, he pressed even more on Musashi, who had far surpassed his limit and was drunker than he ever had been before.
"Wake up!"
Baiken called to his wife.
"Let our guests sleep there. You and I can sleep in the back room. Go spread some bedding."
The woman did not budge.
"Get up!"
Baiken said more loudly.
"Our guest is tired. Let him go to bed now."
His wife's feet were nice and warm now. Getting up would be uncomfortable.
"You said he could sleep in the smithy with Yua," she mumbled.
"Enough of your back talk. Do as I say."
She got up in a huff and stalked off to the back room. Baiken took the sleeping baby in his arms and said,
"The quilts are old, but the fire's right here beside you. If you get thirsty, there's hot water on it for tea. Go to bed. Make yourself comfortable."
He too went into the back room. When the woman came back to exchange pillows, the sullenness was gone from her face.
"My husband's very drunk, too," she said, "and he's probably tired from his trip. He says he plans to sleep late, so make yourself comfortable and sleep as long as you want. Tomorrow I'll give you a nice hot breakfast."
"Thanks."
Musashi could think of nothing more to say. He could hardly wait to get out of his leather socks and cloak.
"Thanks a lot."
He dived into the still warm quilts, but his own body was even hotter from drink. The wife stood in the doorway watching him, then quietly blew out the candle and said, "Good night." Musashi's head felt as if it had a tight steel band around it. His temples throbbed painfully. He wondered why he had drunk so much more than usual. He felt awful, but couldn't help thinking about Baiken. Why had the blacksmith, who had seemed hardly civil at first, suddenly grown friendly and sent out for more sake? Why had his disagreeable wife become sweet and solicitous all of a sudden? Why had they given him this warm bed? It all seemed inexplicable, but before Musashi had solved the mystery, drowsiness overcame him. He closed his eyes, took a few deep breaths, and pulled the covers up. Only his forehead remained exposed, lit up by occasional sparks from the hearth. By and by, there was the sound of deep, steady breathing. Baiken's wife retreated stealthily into the back room, the pit and pad of her feet moving stickily across the tatami. Musashi had a dream, or rather the fragment of one, which kept repeating itself.
A childhood memory flitted about his sleeping brain like an insect, trying, it seemed, to write something in luminescent letters. He heard the words of a lullaby. Go to sleep, go to sleep. Sleeping babies are sweet. He was back home in Mimasaka, hearing the lullaby the blacksmith's wife had sung in the Ise dialect. He was a baby in the arms of a light-skinned woman of about 30, his mother. This woman must be his mother. At his mother's breast, he looked up at her white face. Naughty, and they make their mothers cry too. Cradling him in her arms, his mother sang softly. Her thin, well-bred face looked faintly bluish, like a pear blossom. There was a wall, a long stone wall, on which there was liverwort, and a dirt wall above which branches darkened in the approaching night. Light from a lamp streamed from the house. Tears glistened on his mother's cheeks. The baby looked in wonder at the tears.
Go away! Go back to your home!
It was the forbidding voice of Munisai, coming from inside the house, and it was a command. Musashi's mother arose slowly. She ran along a long stone embankment. Weeping, she ran into the river and waded toward the center. Unable to talk, the baby squirmed in his mother's arms, tried to tell her there was danger ahead. The more he fretted, the more tightly she held him. Her moistened cheek rubbed against his.
Takezo, she said, are you your father's child or your mother's?
Munisai shouted from the bank. His mother sank beneath the water. The baby was cast up on the pebbly bank where he lay wailing at the top of his lungs amid blooming primroses. Musashi opened his eyes. When he started to doze off again, a woman, his mother, someone else, intruded into his dream and woke him again. Musashi could not remember his mother's appearance. He thought of her often, but he couldn't have drawn her face. Whenever he saw another mother, he thought perhaps his own mother had looked the same.
Why tonight? He thought.
The sake had worn off. He opened his eyes and gazed at the ceiling. Amid the blackness of the soot was a reddish light, the reflection from the embers in the hearth. His gaze came to rest on the pinwheel suspended from the ceiling above him. He noticed, too, that the smell of mother and child still clung to the bed covers. With a vague feeling of nostalgia, he lay half asleep, staring at the pinwheel. The pinwheel started slowly to revolve. There was nothing strange about this. It was made to turn. But not unless there was a breeze. Musashi started to get up, then stopped and listened closely. There was the sound of a door being slid quietly shut. The pinwheel stopped turning. Musashi quietly put his head back on the pillow and tried to fathom what was going on in the house. He was like an insect under a leaf, attempting to divine the weather above. His whole body was attuned to the slightest change in his surroundings, his sensitive nerves absolutely taut. Musashi knew that his life was in danger. But why? Is it a den of robbers? He asked himself at first. But no, if they were professional thieves, they'd know he had nothing worth stealing. Has he got a grudge against me? That did not seem to work either. Musashi was quite sure he had never even seen Baiken before. Without being able to figure out a motive, he could feel in his skin and bones that someone or something was threatening his very life. He also knew that whatever it was very near. He had to decide quickly whether to lie and wait for it to come or get out of the way ahead of time. Slipping his hand over the threshold into the smithy, he groped for his sandals. He slipped first one, then the other, under the cover and down to the foot of the bedding. The pinwheel started to whirl again. In the light of the fire, it turned like a bewitched flower. Footsteps were faintly audible both inside and outside the house, as Musashi quietly wadded the bedding together into the rough shape of a human body. Under the short curtain hanging in the doorway appeared two eyes, belonging to a man crawling in with his sword unsheathed. Another, carrying a lance and clinging closely to the wall, crept around to the foot of the bed. The two stared at the bedclothes, listening for the sleeper's breathing. Then, like a cloud of smoke, a third man jumped forward. It was Baiken, holding the sickle in his left hand and the ball in his right. The men's eyes met, and they synchronized their breathing. The man at the head of the bed kicked the pillow into the air, and the man at the foot, jumping down into the smithy, aimed his lance at the reclining form. Keeping the sickle behind him, Baiken shouted, "Up, Musashi!" Neither answer nor movement came from the bedding. The man with the lance threw back the covers. "He's not here!" he shouted. Baiken, casting a confused look around the room, caught sight of the rapidly whirling pinwheel.
"There's a door open somewhere!" he shouted.
Soon another man cried out angrily. The door from the smithy onto a path that went around to the back of the house was open about 3 feet, and a biting wind was blowing in.
"He got out through here!"
"What are those fools doing?"
Baiken screamed, running outside. From under the eaves and out of the shadows, black forms came forward.
"Master, did it go all right?"
asked a low voice excitedly.
Baiken glowered with rage. "What do you mean, you idiot? Why do you think I put you out here to keep watch? He's gone! He must have come this way!"
"Gone? How could he get out?"
"You're asking me, you thick-headed ass!"
Baiken went back inside and stamped around nervously.
"There are only 2 ways he could have gone. He either went up to Suzuka Ford or back to the Tsu Highway. Whichever it was, he couldn't have gone far. Go get him!"
"Which way do you think he went?"
"Ugh! I'll go toward Suzuka. You cover the lower road."
The men inside joined forces with the men outside, making a motley group of about 10, all armed. One of them, carrying a musket, looked like a hunter. Another, with a short-field sword, was probably a woodcutter. As they parted, Baiken shouted,
"If you find him, fire the gun, then everybody come together."
They set off at great speed, but after about an hour came straggling back, looking hangdog and talking dejectedly among themselves. They expected a tongue-lashing from their leader, but when they reached the house, they found Baiken sitting on the ground in the smithy, eyes downcast and expressionless. When they tried to cheer him up, he said,
"No use crying about it now."
Searching about for a way to vent his wrath, he seized a piece of charred wood and broke it sharply over his knee.
"Bring some sake! I want a drink!"
He stirred up the fire again and threw on more kindling. Baiken's wife, trying to quiet the baby, reminded him there was no more sake. One of the men volunteered to bring some from his house, which he did with dispatch. Soon the brew was warm, and the cups were being passed around. The conversation was sporadic and gloomy.
"It makes me mad."
"The rotten little bastard!"
"He leads a charmed life. I'll say that for him."
"Don't worry about it, Master. You did everything you could. The men outside fell down on their job."
Those referred to apologized shamefacedly. They tried to get Baiken drunk so he would go to sleep, but he just sat there, frowning at the bitterness of the sake, but taking no one to task for the failure. Finally, he said,
"I shouldn't have made such a big thing out of it, getting so many of you to help. I could have handled him all by myself, but I thought I'd better be careful. After all, he did kill my brother, and Tsujikaze Tenma was no mean fighter."
"Could that Ronin really be the boy who was hiding in Oko's house 4 years ago?
"He must be. My dead brother's spirit brought him here, I'm sure. At first the thought never crossed my mind, but then he told me he'd been at Sekigahara, and his name used to be Takezo. He's the right age and the right type of person to have killed my brother. I know it was him."
"Come on, Master. Don't think about it any more tonight. Lie down. Get some sleep."
They all helped him to bed. Someone picked up the pillow that had been kicked aside and put it under his head. The instant Baiken's eyes were closed, the anger that had filled him was replaced by loud snoring. The men nodded to each other and drifted off, dispersing into the mist of early morning. They were all riffraff, underlings of freebooters like Tsujikaze Tenma of Ibuki and Tsujikaze Kohei of Yasugawa, who now called himself Shishido Baiken. Or else they were hangers-on at the bottom of the ladder in open society. Driven by the changing times, they had become farmers or artisans or hunters, but they still had teeth, which were only too ready to bite honest people when the opportunity arose. The only sounds in the house were those made by the sleeping inhabitants and the gnawing of a field rat. In the corner of the passageway connecting the workroom and kitchen, next to a large earthen oven, stood a stack of firewood. Above this hung an umbrella and heavy straw rain capes. In the shadows between the oven and the wall, one of the rain capes moved, slowly and quietly inching up the wall until it hung on a nail. The smoky figure of a man suddenly seemed to come out of the wall itself. Musashi had never gone a step away from the house. After slipping out from under the covers, he had opened the outer door and then merged with the firewood, drawing the rain cape down over him. He walked silently across the smithy and looked at Baiken.
Adenoids, thought Musashi, for the snoring was thunderous.
The situation struck him as humorous, and his face twisted into a grin. He stood there for a moment, thinking. To all intents and purposes, he had won his bout with Baiken. It had been a clear-cut victory. Still, this man lying here was the brother of Tsujikaze Tenma, and had tried to murder him to comfort the spirit of his dead brother, an admirable sentiment for a mere freebooter. Should Musashi kill him? If he left him alive, he would go on looking for an opportunity to take his revenge, and the safe course was doubtless to do away with him here and now. But there remained the question of whether he was worth killing. Musashi pondered for a time before hitting on what seemed exactly the right solution. Going to the wall by Baiken's feet, he took down one of the blacksmith's own weapons. While he eased the blade from its groove, he examined the sleeping face. Then, wrapping a piece of damp paper around the blade, he carefully laid it across Baiken's neck. He stepped back and admired his handiwork. The pinwheel was sleeping too. If it were not for the paper wrapping, thought Musashi, the wheel might wake in the morning and turn wildly at the sight of its master's head fallen from the pillow. When Musashi had killed Tsujikaze Tenma, he had had a reason. And anyway, he had still been burning with the fever of battle. But he had nothing to gain from taking the blacksmith's life. And who could tell? If he did kill him, the infant owner of the pinwheel might spend his life seeking to avenge his father's murder. It was a night on which Musashi had thought time and again of his own father and mother. He felt a little envious as he stood here by the sleeping family, sensing the faint sweet scent of mother's milk about him. He even felt a little reluctant to take his leave. In his heart, he spoke to them.
I'm sorry to have troubled you. Sleep well.
He quietly opened the outer door and went out. The Flying Horse. Otsu and Jotaro arrived at the barrier late at night, stopped over at an inn, and resumed their journey before the morning mist cleared. From Mount Fudeste, they walked to Yonkenjaya, where they first felt the warmth of the rising sun on their backs.
"How beautiful!"
exclaimed Otsu, pausing to look at the great golden orb. She seemed full of hope and cheer. It was one of those wonderful moments when all living things, even plants and animals, must feel satisfaction and pride in their existence here on Earth. Jotaro said with obvious pleasure, "We're the very first people on the road, not a soul ahead of us." You sound boastful. What difference does it make?
It makes a lot of difference to me.
Do you think it'll make the road shorter?
Oh, it's not that. It just feels good to be first, even on the road. You have to admit it's better than following along behind palanquins or horses.
That's true.
When no one else is on the road I'm on, I have the feeling it belongs to me.
In that case, why don't you pretend you're a great samurai on horseback, surveying your vast estates? I'll be your attendant.
She picked up a bamboo stick and, waving it ceremoniously, called out in sing-song fashion,
"Bow down, all! Bow down for his lordship!"
A man looked out inquiringly from under the eaves of a tea-house. Caught playing like a child, she blushed and walked rapidly on.
"You can't do that," Jotaro protested. "You mustn't run away from your master. If you do, I'll have to put you to death."
"I don't want to play anymore."
"You're the one who was playing, not me."
"Yes, but you started it." "Oh my, the man at the tea house is still staring at us. He must think we're silly."
"Let's go back there."
"What for?"
"I'm hungry."
"Already? Couldn't we eat half of the rice balls we brought for lunch now?"
"Be patient. We haven't covered 2 miles yet.
If I let you, you'd eat 5 meals a day."
"Maybe, but you don't see me riding in palanquins or hiring horses the way you do."
"That was only last night, and then only because it was getting dark and we had to hurry. If you feel that way about it, I'll walk the whole way today."
"It should be my turn to ride today."
"Children don't need to ride."
"But I want to try riding a horse. Can't I? Please?"
"Well, maybe, but only for today.
I saw a horse tied up at the tea house. We could hire it."
"No, it's still too early in the day."
"Then you didn't mean it when you said I could ride."
"I did, but you're not even tired yet. It'd be a waste of money to rent a horse."
"You know perfectly well I never get tired." "I wouldn't get tired if we walked 100 days and 1,000 miles. If I have to wait till I'm worn out, I'll never get to ride a horse. Come on, Otsu, let's rent the horse now, while there aren't any people ahead of us. It'll be a lot safer than when the road is crowded. Please."
Seeing that if they kept this up, they would lose the time they had gained by making an early start, Otsu gave in, and Jotaro, sensing rather than waiting for her nod of approval, raced back to the tea house. Although there actually were 4 tea houses in the vicinity, as the name Yonkenjaya indicated, they were located at various places on the slopes of Mounts Fudeste and Kutsukake. The one they had passed was the only one in sight. Running up to the proprietor and stopping suddenly, Jotaro shouted,
"Hey there! I want a horse! Get one out for me!"
The old man was taking down the shutters, and the boy's lusty cry jarred him into wakefulness. With a sour expression, he grumbled,
"What's all this? Do you have to yell so loud?"
"I need a horse. Please get one ready right away. How much is it to Minakuchi? If it's not too much, I may even take it all the way to Kusatsu."
"Whose little boy are you anyway?"
"I'm the son of my mother and my father," replied
Jotaro impudently.
"I thought you might be the unruly offspring of the storm god."
"You're the storm god, aren't you? You look mad as a thunderbolt."
"Brat!"
"Just bring me the horse."
"I dare say you think that horse is for hire. Well, it isn't. So I fear I shall not have the honor of lending it to your lordship."
Matching the man's tone of voice, Jotaro said,
"Then, sir, shall I not have the pleasure of renting it?"
"Sassy, aren't you?"
cried the man, taking a piece of lighted kindling from the fire under his oven and throwing it at the boy. The flaming stick missed Jotaro, but struck the ancient horse tied under the eaves. With an air-splitting whinny, she reared, striking her back against the beam.
"You bastard!"
screamed the proprietor. He leapt out of the shop, sputtering curses, and ran up to the animal. As he untied the rope and led the horse around to the side yard, Jotaro started in again.
"Please, lend her to me?"
"I can't."
"Why not?"
"I don't have a groom to send with her."
Now at Jotaro's side,
Otsu suggested that if there was no groom, she could pay the fee in advance and send the horse back from Minakuchi with a traveler coming this way. Her appealing manner softened the old man.